Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson. Today, we're cutting straight through the noise surrounding Washington, D.C. We're going to give you a really comprehensive look at the whirlwind of federal activity just over the last 48 hours. This is your essential briefing, the federal news update for Friday, October 24th, 2025.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. You know, usually when we do a deep dive into 48 hours, it gives us context, maybe a few major rulings, perhaps a bill signing. But this period, starting October 23rd, it feels, well, less like just news and more like a real pivotal moment.
Absolutely.
It feels like the executive branch basically seized the structural vacuum that was created by all this legislative paralysis. We're looking at major policy shifts, economic, judicial, structural stuff, all pushed through by executive fiat. It's quite something.
That legislative paralysis is absolutely critical context, definitely. But before we even get to Congress's inaction, we really have to talk about the economic foundation underlying, well, pretty much every decision made this week. There was a major and, frankly, pretty terrifying financial milestone the nation hit on Wednesday, wasn't there?
There absolutely was. And it's a moment that honestly should probably alarm every taxpayer, you know, regardless of their political stripe. On Wednesday, October 23rd, the U.S. gross national debt officially surpassed $38
trillion. $38
trillion. And Alex, the sheer speed of this accumulation is just staggering. This jump from $37 trillion to $38 trillion. It was the fastest accumulation of $1 trillion outside of that frantic spending during the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic.
$38 trillion. That number feels so abstract. But what does that rapid acceleration really signal about the government's current fiscal path? Where are we heading?
Well, it signals instability, immediate crowding out of future priorities, basically. That debt figure, it dictates the fiscal environment for every single policy choice being made right now, from tariffs to staffing cuts, everything.
And because we have to pay the interest, right?
Exactly. We have to pay interest on that debt and those interest costs. They are now the fastest growing part of the entire federal budget. It's overtaking other categories.
I know the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, they track this stuff meticulously. How does that rapid accumulation, that extra trillion so quickly, translate into future interest payments? What does that look like?
The comparison is pretty stark, actually. If you look back at the past decade, the nation spent about $4 trillion on net interest payments.
Okay.
Now look forward. Over the next 10 years, we're projected to spend a staggering $14 trillion just on interest.
$14 trillion, just interest.
It's just interest. And to put $14 trillion into perspective for you, that's roughly the equivalent of running the entire Department of Defense for about 18 years. Or think of it this way, it's more than quadrupling the total discretionary spending on education, infrastructure, and NASA combined over that same 10-year period.
So essentially, a bigger and bigger slice of the national budget pie is just going to service old debt rather than, you know, investing in the future or current needs.
Precisely. And the impact isn't just on government services, things we might see cut. The GAO, the Government Accountability Office, warns that this translates into very concrete pain for you, the consumer.
How so?
Higher borrowing costs for things like mortgages, credit cards, car loans. It leads to lower real wages over time, ultimately eroding your purchasing power and making key goals, like, say, achieving homeownership or even just paying for college, increasingly harder for future generations. That's the precarious financial tightrope the federal government is walking right now.
Wow. Okay. Well, speaking of things that aren't working, let's turn to the legislative branch. We are now on day 23 of the government shutdown.
Day 23.
Which marks this as the second longest congressional appropriations lapse on record. And let's be clear, this is a political choice, right? Not some kind of budget impossibility. What is the fundamental, immovable sticking point that has kept the lights off for almost a month now?
The core impasse, it really hinges entirely on healthcare subsidies, specifically subsidies related to the Affordable Care Act, the ACA. Congressional Democrats have drawn a very clear red line.
Wishes.
They will not vote for a continuing resolution, a CR, to reopen the government until expiring ACA healthcare subsidies are addressed, period.
Okay, let's make sure we understand who is affected by these expiring subsidies. Who are we talking about here?
So these subsidies were expanded during the pandemic, and they made coverage cheaper for millions of Americans, particularly middle-income families who buy their insurance on the ACA marketplace. If Congress doesn't act, those subsidies just vanish.
And the implications if they vanish?
They're severe. It could mean upward pressure on insurance rates for pretty much everyone. We're seeing projections of maybe 30% increases in states like Colorado. And estimates suggest as many as 15 million people could lose their insurance coverage entirely because they just can't afford the premiums anymore without that help.
15 million people.
Uh-huh.
And the Republican position remains rigid.
Pretty much open the government first, then we'll negotiate health care later. That's the stance.
That's the strategic lock, then.
That's the lock. Senate Majority Leader John Thune and the GOP leadership are holding firm. They argue that, you know, using a government shutdown as leverage to demand specific policy spending, in this case, the ACA subsidies, is just unacceptable.
Their line is they're willing to talk, but only after.
Only after the Democrats vote to reopen the government first. They say they're willing to discuss health care reform broadly, sure, but not under these conditions. And this immovable standoff, well, it means that hundreds of thousands of federal employees are effectively being used as political pawns in this fight.
And that takes us directly to what happened in the Senate on October 23rd. We saw this political gamesmanship playing out explicitly with federal employees' paychecks, didn't we? The GOP brought forward something called the Shutdown Fairness Act, S3012. Can you unpack the mechanism of this bill and why Democrats rejected it?
Right, the Shutdown Fairness Act. It was championed by Senator Ron Johnson, and it was designed to be, let's say, highly selective. Its core proposal was to immediately pay only the accepted federal employees.
Define accepted for us.
Those are the folks required to show up to work without pay during a shutdown. Think TSA agents, air traffic controllers, active military personnel, certain law enforcement. This bill would have paid them. But, and this is the key part, it explicitly withheld pay from the hundreds of thousands of furloughed workers, the ones sent home.
And that bill failed.
It failed. The vote was 54-45, which is short of the 60 votes needed to break a filibuster for cloture.
Okay, wait. If the bill proposed paying essential workers, the people keeping critical functions going, why would Democrats object? On the surface, it seems maybe fiscally responsible to at least pay the people who are actually working.
Ah, but that's where the political strategy comes in, you see. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer immediately called the bill a ruse. And their critique was, well, it was multifaceted, quite structural, actually.
What were the main points?
First, they argued it created two classes of federal employees. It fundamentally divided the workforce against itself, the paid versus the unpaid. Second, and this was really crucial, by only paying the accepted staff, the bill gave the executive branch, the administration, this huge discretionary power.
Power to do what?
Power to decide who was essential and therefore got paid and who was non-essential and effectively penalized by getting nothing.
Ah, so it was seen as handing the president a tool to manage, maybe even punish, certain agencies or departments just by declaring their staff non-essential.
Exactly. It was viewed as a political weaponization of the shutdown itself. And, importantly, the GOP bill did absolutely nothing to address the looming threat of reductions in force, or RIFs, basically, layoffs, which were already starting to be handed out.
So Democrats didn't just reject it, they offered alternatives.
They countered immediately with alternatives, yes.
Tell us about the true Shutdown Fairness Act. What did the Democratic proposal aim to achieve that the GOP one didn't?
Senators Van Hollen and Peters put forward the true Shutdown Fairness Act. Their proposal was much more comprehensive. It sought to ensure immediate back pay for all federal employees, both furloughed and accepted, along with the military. And crucially, it also included contractors, who often get left out.
But the biggest difference wasn't just who got paid, was it? There was something about RIFs.
That was the most significant difference, I'd say. The bill included an explicit clause to prevent the administration from conducting any RIFs during the funding lapse. They recognized the severe toll these RIF notices were already taking on people.
But despite these proposals, both Democratic alternatives were immediately struck down by Republicans, correct?
That's right, blocked, which ensured that the total gridlock on employee pay continues.
So the Senate remains locked. Pay becomes a casualty of the larger policy standoff over health care. And this immediately translated into, what, operational chaos across the administrative state?
Pretty much, yeah. Immediate operational chaos.
Let's look at that immediate agency fallout then, because we saw some critical services being, well, rescued by some pretty unusual means this week.
A prime example is the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS. They were under extreme pressure because the crucial open enrollment period for healthcare was starting.
A huge undertaking, even in normal times.
Absolutely. So to manage this influx, CMS had to recall nearly 3,000 furloughed employees. That's about half its entire workforce brought back from furlough.
And how did they pay them during a shutdown?
That's the unusual part. To cover the expense of this mass recall during the shutdown, they had to utilize research data sharing user fees. Essentially, money generated from sharing data with researchers was diverted to fund the salaries of these recalled employees.
So they found a workaround, but it's not ideal.
Not at all. While they managed to expand their day-to-day operations for enrollment, core activities like issuing new contracts or external communications, those remain strictly limited. It's a patch, not a fix.
The strain on the workforce is just palpable, and the IRS in particular seems to be imposing some exceptionally harsh, almost punitive leave policies during this crisis.
Oh, they are operating under extreme duress. The IRS told its exempt employees, the ones still working, that if they took more than 8 hours of leave per two-week pay period, they would be immediately furloughed, sent home without pay.
More than 8 hours in 2 weeks? That's incredibly strict.
It is, and we saw real-world cruelty as a result. Employees were literally called back from approved paid parental leave. Others were forced to abandon previously approved medical or personal leave just to avoid being categorized as non-compliant and being sent home without pay. It's a policy designed to enforce total presence, regardless of personal necessity or prior approval.
Just brutal. And it wasn't just the IRS or the furloughed staff feeling the pinch, right? Even some exempted staff, the people legally supposed to be working and eventually paid, face delays.
Indeed. The FDA reported some kind of glitch that was the official term that delayed paychecks even for some of their staff who were legally supposed to be exempt from the shutdown's immediate financial pain. This obviously led to widespread uncertainty and anxiety.
And the rhetoric from the administration wasn't exactly soothing, was it?
Hardly. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, speaking to air traffic controllers who are absolutely essential personnel, remember, and were set to miss their first full paycheck next week, he simply encouraged them to, quote, come to work, even if you do not get a paycheck.
Come to work, even if you don't get paid.
That's a stark reflection of how critical services are being sustained right now, basically on goodwill and arguably forced labor during this complete legislative failure.
The operational strain is just immense. Okay, so while Congress was paralyzed and the civil service is being stretched to the breaking point, the executive branch was moving with aggressive speed. Let's pivot now to the major policy decisions enacted by executive fiat this week, starting with a really significant trade action. On October 23rd, the president issued a proclamation under Section 232 imposing new tariffs.
Right. This is a textbook example of using existing executive authority, in this case Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, to enact highly specific industrial policy. The action targets the medium and heavy-duty vehicle sector, think big trucks, MHDVs their parts, MHDVPs, and also buses.
And these are effective when?
Effective very soon, November 1st, 2025. The justification given was national security, arguing that foreign dependence on these specific vehicles, which are critical for military logistics, supply chains, emergency response, constitutes a threat.
But this wasn't just a broad tariff hammer thrown down, was it? It seemed more like a surgical tool, very targeted. What were the specific rates, and how are these tariffs structured? It seems like they're designed to achieve a very specific goal. Fundamentally reshaping the North American automotive supply chain.
It's extremely sophisticated in its structure, yes. The base rates are set at 25% ad valorem, meaning 25% of the assessed value on the MHDVs themselves and key parts, specifically things like engines, transmissions, and chassis. Imported buses face a slightly lower 10% tariff.
Okay, now let's talk about the structural incentives woven into this, because this is where the policy gets really quite complex. It includes a specific carve-out related to the USMCA trade agreement, right? Mexico and Canada.
That's the first major structural lever they're pulling. You have to understand, roughly 78% of U.S. heavy truck imports come from Mexico, and another 15% or so from Canada. That's over 90%, all governed by USMCA.
So how does the tariff interact with USMCA?
The administration specifically structured the 25% tariff to apply only to the non-U.S. content of USMCA-produced vehicles. So, let's say a truck is assembled in Mexico using 60% North American content, but maybe only 30% of that content is actually sourced from U.S. suppliers. That 25% tariff then applies to the remaining 70% of the vehicle's value, the non-U.S. portion.
Ah, okay. So this is designed to put pressure on Mexico and Canada and the global companies operating there to source a vastly larger proportion of their components from U.S. suppliers if they want to minimize that tariff hit. It's like a mechanism to push supply chain integration northwards into the U.S.
Precisely. It makes using U.S. parts much more attractive financially. But that's not the only lever. What was the second major incentive, the long-term one?
The second incentive is what they're calling the domestic assembly offset. And crucially, this runs through 2030, signaling a long-term commitment to this policy.
What does it do?
Manufacturers who commit to performing the final assembly of these MHDVs in the U.S. receive a credit, essentially a rebate, equal to 3.75% of the manufacturer's suggested retail price, the MSRP, of that U.S.-assembled vehicle. So you assemble it here, you get a discount.
Exactly. It's explicitly designed to make the United States the single most attractive final assembly point within the entire North American manufacturing block. Combine the pressure on part sourcing with a direct incentive for final assembly.
It's a very complex, very top-down attempt at industrial planning by executive decree, leveraging U.S. market access to force specific supply chain shifts. What was the immediate response from the industries that actually, you know, buy and use these trucks, the trucking companies, the businesses?
The reaction was immediate and pretty negative, especially from consumer-facing groups. Industry groups like the American Trucking Association, the ATA, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce warned unequivocally that these tariffs are going to lead to higher acquisition costs for the carriers who operate these fleets.
And those costs don't just stop with the trucking companies, do they?
Of course not. They are inevitably passed on down the chain to you, the consumer, in the form of higher prices for goods and for shipping. So this action, while it's strategically aimed at supply chain independence, is widely projected to exacerbate existing inflationary concerns. Which is interesting, right? Because it comes precisely when the administration is publicly claiming to be fighting rising prices.
A potential contradiction there. Okay, let's shift gears. We move now from sort of economic warfare via tariffs to regulatory policy achieved through a very different tool, clemency. On October 23rd, the president granted a full pardon to Changpeng Zhao, better known as CZ, the founder and former CEO of the giant crypto exchange Binance. This sends a huge signal to the entire digital finance world.
Huge signal. CZ, as he's widely known, had pleaded guilty to willfully violating the Bank Secrecy Act, the BSA. He'd served a four-month sentence already. But the context of his company's crime is really critical here.
Remind.
Binance, the company, settled with the Department of Justice for an astronomical $4.3 billion fine. Why? Because the platform had systematically failed to maintain adequate anti-money laundering controls. Just completely failed.
And the DOJ's findings were explicit about who those failures enabled, weren't they? It wasn't just minor stuff.
Not at all. They were very explicit. The DOJ stated that Binance enabled transactions linked directly to U.S.-designated terrorist organizations. We're talking Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, ISIS.
Wow.
Plus transactions tied to child abuse material distribution, illicit drug sales online, ransomware proceeds, and other severe global crimes. This was not some minor regulatory oversight. The DOJ basically accused Binance of facilitating a major global financial crime network.
Okay, given that incredibly serious context, facilitating terror financing, billions in fines, why the full pardon now, was this framed as simple mercy for an individual who served his time, or was there something more to it?
It was framed explicitly as a policy correction, not just mercy. The White House press secretary actually stated that Zhao was, quote, prosecuted by the Biden administration in their war on cryptocurrency, end quote, and then declared, the war on crypto is over.
The war on crypto is over.
That's the key insight here. The administration is utilizing the unilateral power of clemency, not just to forgive an individual, but to achieve a broad regulatory outcome. It's signaling an end to aggressive oversight and enforcement across the entire digital asset sector.
That is a really stunning use of the pardon power, effectively using a criminal justice intervention, or rather the reversal of one, to alter financial regulation policy for a whole industry. And this action is deeply complicated, isn't it, by reported financial entanglements linked to the president's own family?
It raises significant questions of influence and potential conflict of interest, yes. Reporting indicates that shortly before this pardon was announced, Binance facilitated a very large transaction, something like a $2 million exchange for an Emirati investment fund. And reportedly, Binance agreed to have those funds paid out in a specific cryptocurrency, one developed by the president's family's own crypto venture, World Liberty Financial.
Ah. So how does the pardon connect to the family's business interests, potentially?
Well, think about it. The pardon, by signaling regulatory safety and an end to the quote-unquote war on crypto, immediately confers greater legitimacy and stability upon the entire digital asset market. For a newly launched digital currency like the one associated with World Liberty Financial, legitimacy is arguably the most valuable asset it can have.
So the pardon reduces the perceived risk.
It reduces the perceived risk of aggressive government enforcement action, potentially boosting the value and adoption rate of new connected digital currencies like theirs. Critics view the pardon as a direct, unilateral use of executive power to achieve a regulatory environment that's highly favorable to specific financial allies and potentially the president's own family business interests, all done under the public guise of ending a war on crypto.
Serious questions there. Okay, moving from economic policy and clemency to domestic security. We saw a really remarkable, very public reversal of policy in San Francisco this week. It seems to illustrate how direct private influence can instantly change executive action.
Yeah, this is the story of the canceled San Francisco surge. The administration had publicly announced and planned a very high-profile deployment. It was supposed to be a federal surge of law enforcement, including Customs and Border Protection, CBP, and even National Guard personnel, into San Francisco.
And the stated goal?
The stated goal was to combat rising crime statistics and also enhance immigration enforcement in the city. This tactic, you know, it aligned with previous federal operations we've seen targeting crime in major urban centers.
But the cancellation was incredibly abrupt. Who convinced the president to reverse a publicly announced security policy literally overnight?
The cancellation was announced by the president himself, and his explanation was, well, highly revealing. He initially mentioned having a very nice phone call with San Francisco Mayor Daniel Lurie, who apparently asked for some time to handle the situation locally first.
Okay, fair enough.
But that wasn't the whole story.
Not according to the president. He then explicitly named two corporate friends of mine who he said called him the previous night, urging him to halt the deployment. And he named them NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang and Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff.
Two very powerful tech CEOs based in that region. So the input of a few highly influential corporate allies successfully overrode a publicly announced domestic security operation. And we should probably note the context here, too. Some of these corporate leaders are reported to be major private donors to that controversial White House ballroom project we'll talk about later. It's a critical link. This sequence provides a highly visible, very public demonstration of how direct private influence from major economic elites can apparently instantly supersede publicly stated domestic security policy. It fundamentally blurs the line between private interest. Presumably, these companies wanted to avoid the economic disruption or maybe just the optics of a federal troop presence in their backyard and executive action at the highest levels of governance.
It's a really powerful illustration of the maybe transactional nature of high-level policymaking right now.
It certainly appears that way in this instance.
This sort of transactional governance seems to extend to foreign policy as well. We saw the administration hardening its stance on Russia, but also engaging in some arguably reckless rhetoric regarding drug cartels operating out of Venezuela.
On Russia, we saw concrete action this week. The administration imposed new Ukraine-related sanctions on two major Russian oil giants, Lukoil and Rosneft.
What triggered that?
Well, it marks a potential hardening of the U.S. approach, particularly as it came immediately after a planned summit between the president and Vladimir Putin was abruptly shelved, apparently due to stalled ceasefire negotiations in Ukraine.
And the immediate impact of those sanctions.
A noticeable, though perhaps temporary, spike in global oil prices. Hitting Russian energy always has ripple effects.
But it was the rhetoric regarding Venezuela that really raised some deep constitutional red flags, wasn't it? Specifically regarding the executive's authority to use military force without Congress.
Absolutely. The president made a really striking, frankly inflammatory statement regarding potential military strikes against suspected drug smugglers operating from Venezuela.
Yeah.
He seemed to just dismiss the need for a formal declaration of war or even congressional consultation.
What did he say exactly?
He stated, quite unequivocally, quote, "I think we're just going to kill people that are bringing drugs into our country. Okay, we're going to kill them," end quote.
We're going to kill them. That is extremely aggressive language, and it seems to challenge decades of constitutional interpretation regarding the War Powers Act and congressional authority.
It is. Legal experts immediately raised profound constitutional concerns about the unilateral nature of military action without any congressional authorization. And this rhetoric, it comes amid ongoing action, too. The U.S. launched its 8th and 9th vessel strikes just this week in the Eastern Pacific against vessels suspected of transporting drugs.
So the statement indicates perhaps a growing willingness by the executive to conduct military operations based solely on internal policy aims, completely sidestepping the legislative branch.
That's certainly how it's being interpreted by many constitutional scholars, a very muscular assertion of executive power in the military domain.
These high-profile policy shifts are being matched by some really dramatic changes to the physical infrastructure of government itself. specifically the White House. The East Wing is, well, it's gone, replaced by rubble. And this is now the centerpiece of a major controversy over what some are calling governance by fait accompli.
That's right. The complete demolition of the historic White House East Wing was completed on or around October 23rd, all to make way for this new, privately funded ballroom.
And the cost keeps rising.
It does. The project, initially scoped at around $200 million, has already seen its estimated cost balloon to approximately $300 million. And it's all being sourced from private donors, including major tech, finance, and defense firms like Apple, Amazon, Google, Meta, Lockheed Martin, Palantir. A who's who of corporate power.
Now, the controversy isn't just the expense or the structure itself, but the process. It appears to have completely circumvented the standard federal oversight procedures, right? How did they achieve this demolition so quickly and apparently without public review?
They seem to have leveraged the administrative vacuum created by the shutdown, among other things. The project proceeded without any consultation or public review from key oversight bodies like the National Capital Planning Commission, the NCPC. Normally, the NCPC review is required for such significant modifications to federal monuments and buildings in the Capital Region.
And the administration's justification for skipping that.
They argued, rather technically, that NCPC approval is only required for vertical construction. Since demolition isn't technically vertical construction, they claimed they didn't need the approval yet.
And this idea of fait accompli governance by accomplished fact that seems central to the strategy here. Demolish first, ask questions later.
Critics argue it was a deliberate strategy. They specifically cited the timing of the demolition, conducting it during the government shutdown period when the NCPC was officially closed and literally unable to meet or respond as a conscious maneuver.
Why do it then?
To ensure that the work was done irreversible before any legal challenges could be effectively mounted. By using the political shutdown as cover, they arguably rendered any challenge to the demolition itself moot. The building is already gone.
Has there been any legal pushback?
There has. A lawsuit has now been filed seeking a temporary restraining order against any further construction work on the site. So the fight over the ballroom itself isn't over, but the East Wing is history.
This demolition really illustrates the urgency and maybe the finality of executive action while the legislative branch is stalled. Meanwhile, the agency that actually manages the physical footprint of the federal government, the General Services Administration, or GSA, is getting new leadership. Leadership focused on solving what sounds like an enormous and expensive maintenance crisis across federal buildings.
That's right. Ed Forst, a seasoned real estate and finance executive, was nominated this week to lead GSA, and he has vowed to tackle what he called the delinquent condition of the federal building stock.
Delinquent, that's strong language. What are the numbers like?
The numbers are daunting. GSA manages something like 363 million square feet of space, and Forst noted the agency faces a deferred maintenance backlog of about $24
billion. $24
billion. With a B, and he specified that $6 billion of that is categorized as urgently needed within the next 2 years just to keep buildings operational.
He used some colorful sort of non-bureaucratic language to describe the scale of the problem, didn't he?
He did. He admitted that, quote, deferred maintenance is a very gentle term for, I'll say, delinquent maintenance. His mandate seems clear. Right size the portfolio.
What does right sizing mean in this context?
He noted that on average, federal office space is only about 60% occupied. This is primarily due to the big shifts to remote and hybrid work post-pandemic. So his goal appears to be massive consolidation of underutilized properties, aiming to save taxpayer money by selling off buildings or moving agencies out of expensive, often dilapidated, leased spaces into consolidated, hopefully modernized federal hubs.
Makes sense. But beyond just bricks and mortar, GSA is also right at the center of the administration's big push for technological modernization, isn't it? Specifically, the centralized adoption of artificial intelligence, AI.
Yes, absolutely. Through GSA's OneGov initiative, which is aimed at centralizing and streamlining acquisitions, they're making deals with major tech companies, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, the usual suspects. But one specific AI deployment drew immediate, sharp concern this week from ranking member Gary Peters in the Senate.
Which one was that?
It was GSA's deal with Elon Musk's company, xAI, to deploy their large language model called Grok across the federal government.
Grok, okay. What were the specific concerns raised about deploying Grok federally?
Senator Peters cited recent reports detailing that Grok has produced, in his words, racist and inflammatory responses during testing phases. The idea of deploying an AI model with known bias issues across the entire federal government, where it could potentially influence everything from regulatory decisions to internal data analysis, maybe even public-facing chatbots, raised serious questions about the vetting process.
What was the nominee Forst's response?
Forst committed to a re-examination of that specific contract, but the deal itself really underscores the speed at which AI is being adopted across government, perhaps some worry outpacing the necessary ethical oversight and testing.
That desire for speed and efficiency, though, it's particularly evident at the agency level, too, specifically in the push to automate really complex governmental processes, like, for example, nuclear licensing.
Yes, this is a fascinating example of very targeted AI implementation. The Idaho National Lab, INL, is working directly with Microsoft on this. They're testing various large language models, including popular ones like Claude and ChatGPT, to see if they can relieve the administrative burden in the application and licensing process for new nuclear reactors. That process is managed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC.
What does that mean in practical terms? Where are the potential time savings actually coming from in that complex process?
It's aimed squarely at eliminating what engineers apparently colloquially call word engineering.
Word engineering.
Yeah. It refers to the slow, laborious, very manual generation of literally thousands of pages of complex engineering reports, safety analyses, environmental impact statements, all required for nuclear licensing. These reports often involve incredibly repetitive data synthesis, cross-referencing standards, ensuring legal compliance checks are met. It's painstaking.
So AI could automate that.
That's the hope. INL projects that by automating the generation, verification, and cross-checking of these complex documents, these AI tools could potentially produce efficiency improvements ranging from 30% to maybe even 50% in the total processing time for an application.
That could dramatically speed up the deployment of new nuclear technology, if it works.
Potentially, yes. That's the goal.
And INL is also looking beyond just the paperwork, right? Into the future of actually operating these facilities using something called digital twins.
That's the really cutting edge stuff. They're focused heavily on developing nuclear reactor digital twins. These are highly accurate virtual replicas of operational reactors fed with real-time data.
What do you do with a virtual reactor?
These digital twins allow operators to run incredibly complex simulations, predict potential failures before they happen, test software updates or procedural changes in a safe virtual environment without risking the actual physical reactor. The ultimate goal,
which is
to enable highly sophisticated remote operation and perhaps eventually even some level of autonomy for entire fleets of reactors. It could fundamentally change how nuclear energy is managed, monitored, and potentially scaled up in the future.
That focus on efficiency and modernization through tech, however, stands in really stark contrast to some major actions taken recently to reshape the federal workforce itself. Actions that critics argue are actively eroding the civil service's merit-based principles. Let's talk about Executive Order 14356, the centralized hiring freeze.
Right. This executive order, signed back on October 15th, but its effects are really being felt now, it's one of the most significant structural changes to federal hiring practices in decades. It essentially prohibits agencies from filling any vacant positions unless they get approval through new layers of politically appointed oversight.
And it created new committees.
Crucially, yes. It mandates the creation of strategic hiring committees within every single agency.
What is the specific mandate of these committees, and why are they considered so controversial by watchdog groups and federal employee unions?
Well, these committees must include the deputy agency head and the agency chief of staff, both typically political appointees. And their explicit direction, written into the EO, is to ensure all hiring is, quote, aligned with the priorities of my administration.
Aligned with the priorities of my administration.
Critics argue this institutionalizes political control over the career civil service. It overrides long-standing merit-based principles established over decades to prevent political cronyism and effectively ensures that perceived loyalty to the current political agenda becomes a primary, maybe the primary, qualification for getting hired or promoted within the career civil service.
And are we already seeing concrete evidence of this impact, particularly in critical areas like, say, cybersecurity?
We are seeing worrying signs, yes. The Cyberspace Solarium Commission 2.0, a bipartisan group focused on cyber defense, reported just this week that progress on national cyber policy is, in their words, stalling, and in several areas, slipping.
And they link this directly to workforce issues.
They lay the blame squarely on workforce destabilization caused by recent administration policies. For instance, they highlighted CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, our main civilian cyber defense agency, has lost about a third of its staff, over 1,000 employees gone.
Why? What did the commission criticize specifically?
They criticized the administration's apparent shift away from prioritizing technical qualifications in hiring and promotions, and also the rollback of diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. They argue that rolling back DEI actually narrowed access to crucial technical talent pools needed for cybersecurity. The bottom line from the commission was stark. When you deprioritize merit and expertise in favor of political alignment, you fundamentally lose the ability to protect the nation's critical infrastructure.
And the pain of these workforce cuts, the hiring freeze, and especially the RIFs, the reductions in force, it's far from theoretical, isn't it? Right. We have numerous really heart-wrenching personal accounts that were given in court testimony this week. They truly put a human face on the systemic stress federal workers are under.
These accounts, they just illustrate the profound emotional and financial terror this policy is inflicting on individuals and families. Several federal employees testified about receiving their second RIF notice just this year. Imagine that uncertainty.
There were some of them?
There was Dorothy Roper at the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control. She had actually been reinstated after an earlier RIF, fought it, and won, only to receive a brand new RIF notice this week, throwing her career back into limbo.
And the story of Mayor Medrano at the Commerce Department was particularly acute, wasn't it?
It really was. Ms. Mbazrana received her first RIF notice earlier this year while she was actually recovering from a stress-induced seizure, likely related to the work environment uncertainty. She, too, was reinstated after a challenge, only to receive a new RIF notice this week. It just demonstrates the relentless uncertainty and the severe psychological torment this policy can inflict.
And these RIFs are hitting employees at moments of maximum personal vulnerability, it seems, even during family leave.
Absolutely. Lamarla Stevens at HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, received her RIF notice while she was still out on approved paid maternity leave. She testified that she now fears losing her promised back pay from the furlough period, and she's facing the completely unexpected and impossible burden of unplanned childcare expenses because she can no longer count on her income or even her employment status returning.
Just devastating. And perhaps the most tragic account involved life-saving medical care, right?
That was Daniel Ronneberg. He's an FAA union president, Federal Aviation Administration. He testified that he fears losing his federal health coverage, which he desperately needs for life-saving post-surgery treatment following a recent kidney transplant. The prospect of losing the absolute foundational necessity for survival health insurance due to political gamesmanship and budget impasses is just, well, it's truly devastating to contemplate.
Has there been any temporary relief for these employees?
Thankfully, yes. The federal courts have offered a temporary shield. A judge expanded an existing temporary restraining order, or TRO, that blocks these RIFs. The expansion now covers more unions and agencies, including places like the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, CFTC, the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, and the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC. But it is just temporary relief for now.
The systematic stress on the federal workforce, the RIFs, the hiring freezes, it really highlights the urgent need for some kind of structural reform, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's kind of remarkable that the U.S. civil service still operates under a framework that's nearly 80 years old.
It is functionally ossified in many ways. The core civil service structure hasn't had significant comprehensive reform since the Classification Act, which was passed, over 75 years ago. This outdated structure leads to significant, well-documented issues. Primarily, the difficulty in effectively addressing poor performance, which in turn degrades morale for high performers and drags down the reputation of the entire workforce. The system was designed for stability above all else, but critics argue it now actively inhibits necessary change, agility, and efficiency.
But there are models for success out there, right?
Yeah.
The source materials we looked at highlighted Tennessee's 2012 TAME Act as a powerful laboratory, maybe a blueprint, for effective civil service reform at the state level.
Yes. Tennessee is often cited as the blueprint for how you might balance performance accountability with fairness to employees. They successfully modernized their state civil service system back in 2012 with the TAME Act that stands for the Tennessee Excellence Accountability and Management Act.
What did it do?
It moved away from traditional tenure protections or bumping rights for new hires, and it streamlined several bureaucratic bottlenecks in hiring and performance management. And the results, according to reports, are dramatic. and they directly contradict the notion that reform must automatically lead to instability or mass departures.
Walk us through some of the key metrics of their success. What changed in Tennessee?
Okay, so before the TAME Act, Tennessee's hiring time often mirrored the slow federal pace, hundreds of days sometimes. After the reform, job filling time dropped significantly from the federal government's own optimistic fantasy target of 80 days down to a swift 47 to 53 days on average in Tennessee.
That's a huge improvement. What about turnover? Did people flee the system?
Quite the opposite, actually. Employee turnover decreased by 22% in 2024 compared to pre-reform levels. Why? Because the new systems apparently did a better job matching talent to the right jobs, and performance management was seen as fairer. Plus, the number of applications for state jobs actually grew by over 60%.
So it proves that thoughtful, strategic reform can actually speed up hiring, improve workforce quality, and enhance retention. It offers maybe a clear path forward if the federal government ever decides to tackle real reform.
It certainly provides a data-driven case study, yes.
Okay, that's the administrative state.
Mm.
But the ultimate battleground for many of the week's events, as it so often is the judiciary. We have two major constitutional cases decided or taken up at the Supreme Court level this week that really demonstrate the deep ideological fissures within the current court. Let's start with the Eighth Amendment challenge to an execution method in Boyd v. Ham.
Right. On October 23rd, the Supreme Court denied a stay of execution for an Alabama inmate, Kenneth Eugene Smith. He was challenging the state's planned use of nitrogen hypoxia, a relatively new and untested execution method, arguing it constituted cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment.
He had presented evidence about the method's effects.
Yes, he presented extensive expert evidence aiming to demonstrate that the method causes unnecessary and extreme suffering, violating constitutional standards.
What specifically does the evidence suggest about the use of nitrogen hypoxia for executions? What's the concern?
The legal challenge was based largely on testimony detailing that nitrogen hypoxia does not result in a quick and painless loss of consciousness, as proponents often claim. Instead, the evidence presented suggested the process causes potentially several minutes of conscious suffocation.
Conscious suffocation.
Yes, and intense psychological torment for the inmate, who would remain aware of their inability to breathe for possibly up to 7 minutes before death actually occurs. The court's denial of the stay means Alabama can proceed with what critics are calling an experimental and potentially torturous method.
The dissent in this case, led by Justice Sotomayor, was extraordinarily powerful and explicit in its condemnation, wasn't it?
It was a scathing 9-page dissent, and importantly, she was joined by Justices Kagan and Jackson. It meticulously detailed the evidence suggesting the method inflicts unnecessary and prolonged suffering. Justice Sotomayor called Alabama's continued pursuit of this nitrogen hypoxia experiment a fundamental failure of the court to uphold basic constitutional guarantees against cruel and unusual punishment.
That language, failure to uphold constitutional guarantees, is very strong.
Extremely strong. The sheer sharpness of the ideological fissure expressed in that dissent, especially on a death penalty procedure case, signals a really deepening conflict among the justices over the fundamental role and reach of the Eighth Amendment in capital punishment cases today.
Okay, shifting from the Eighth Amendment to the Second Amendment, the Supreme Court also agreed this week to hear a major case challenging a longstanding federal law regarding drug users and firearm possession. The case is United States v. Hemaney. This looks like a critical follow-up to the court's landmark 2022 Bruin decision on gun rights.
It absolutely is. This case directly challenges the federal law, 18 U.S.C. Section 922 G3, which prohibits firearm possession by anyone who is an unlawful user of or addicted to any controlled substance. Now, post-Bruin, all modern gun regulations must be tested against the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation.
So the core question here, right?
The core question is whether banning firearms for an entire class of people based solely on their substance use status aligns with historical precedents from the founding era or Reconstruction. Does history support disarming someone just because they use drugs?
And the Department of Justice's strategy in appealing this specific case to the Supreme Court seems highly deliberate. They appear to be setting up the court for a specific kind of ruling, correct? They didn't just pick any case challenging this law.
They absolutely are engaging in strategic litigation here. The DOJ chose to appeal the case involving this particular defendant, Mr. Hemaney, who is, let's just say, decidedly not a sympathetic figure for gun rights advocates.
Why not? What are the details?
Court filings detail his alleged ties to Iran, a U.S. adversary. They also note that cocaine was found in his home during the investigation, in addition to evidence of his marijuana use, which was the basis for the 922G charge. By appealing this specific case with what lawyers call bad facts.
Bad facts, meaning facts unfavorable to the side whose legal principle you might otherwise support.
Exactly. By using bad facts, the government is trying to influence the outcome.
What's the goal of using bad facts in this context? What kind of ruling are they hoping for?
The goal is likely to encourage the court, which is often highly sensitive to public safety concerns, especially those involving drugs or foreign influence, to issue a very narrow ruling. If the court rules narrowly, for example, maybe upholding the ban only for users of hard drugs like cocaine, or perhaps only for those with alleged ties to foreign adversaries, distinguishing them from, say, casual marijuana users in legal states, it might preserve the federal ban in this specific instance.
Rather than issuing a broader ruling.
Rather than issuing a broader ruling based on the historical test alone, which could potentially dismantle the ban on all drug users possessing firearms entirely, the DOJ is essentially trying to thread the needle. Save the statute from being struck down completely by testing the absolute limits of the Bruin standard with a defendant few would rush to defend.
A very calculated legal maneuver. Okay, finally, let's quickly look at a significant ruling from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Supertech, INC v. My Choice Software, LLC. This ruling seems to have important implications for digital commerce and legal jurisdiction in our increasingly online world.
Yes, this is significant for basically anyone conducting business digitally across state or territorial lines. The Ninth Circuit clarified the standard for what's called personal jurisdiction in the digital age. Personal jurisdiction is about whether a court in one location has the power to make legally binding decisions over a person or company located somewhere else.
And what did the Ninth Circuit rule in this case?
They ruled that a California company's targeted sales efforts, specifically including direct email communications aimed at securing a specific government contract, were sufficient actions, sufficient minimum contacts, to subject that California company to a lawsuit way over in the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, the CNMI.
Even though the company wasn't physically present there.
Correct. Just the targeted digital outreach was enough.
What makes that ruling a potential game changer, or at least a significant clarification for businesses operating online?
It signals that simply engaging in targeted digital outreach, especially when you're aiming for potentially high-value contracts or specific customers in another jurisdiction, can be enough to establish those minimum contacts. It means you could be dragged into a courtroom literally thousands of miles away based on your emails or website targeting. It sets a precedent that companies probably need to be much more cautious and aware about who and where they target with their digital sales and marketing efforts, even with something as simple as email correspondence. Jurisdiction follows the targeted contact.
Okay. Sam, as we synthesize this incredibly active, frankly, somewhat chaotic 48 hours, the picture that emerges seems pretty unmistakable, doesn't it? We have a hyper-assertive executive branch using unilateral power tariffs, pardons, workforce restructuring, even physical demolition of historic buildings to enact fundamental long-term policy shifts. And this is all happening in the deep shadow of a politically motivated government shutdown that has effectively pushed the hardest policy fights away from Congress and to the courts and the administrative agencies.
That is absolutely the core takeaway from this period. The legislative gridlock hasn't just stopped things. It has actively created the political space, the vacuum for this massive assertion of executive authority across multiple domains. And for you, the listener, this matters profoundly because these actions, taken just over 48 hours, impact almost everything.
How so? Connect the dots for us.
The price you pay for consumer goods and shipping could rise because of those new MHDV tariffs. The stability and accessibility of the federal services you rely on, whether it's getting a passport, relying on food safety inspections, or expecting smooth air travel, are all threatened by the ongoing shutdown and the RIFs hitting the workforce. And perhaps most fundamentally, the scope of your basic constitutional rights is actively being redefined right now by those Second and Eighth Amendment challenges playing out at the Supreme Court. It's all interconnected.
So to close us out today, let's circle back to that highly visible, maybe even brazen incident in San Francisco. The president explicitly stated that the planned federal law enforcement deployment was halted, not because of a policy reassessment, but due to private back-channel appeals from influential corporate CEOs like Jensen Huang of NVIDIA and Mark Benioff of Salesforce.
It really is a moment of profound revelation about the underlying power dynamics currently at play in Washington. If executive action, whether it involves domestic security deployments like in San Francisco, or crucial regulatory decisions like the CZ pardon, which has potential financial links, or even the physical structure of the White House itself funded by corporate donors, if these actions are increasingly being shaped and influenced, not primarily by law or by public opinion or even by congressional oversight anymore, but by the private, often financial interests of a few select powerful corporate donors and allies.
Then what?
Then the fundamental concept of government accountability in a democracy feels profoundly altered, doesn't it? It raises deep questions about who the government truly serves and how accountable it really is to the public interest versus private influence.
A very profound thought indeed. Something for all of us to mull over as we await what the next week or even the next 48 hours might hold. Thank you, Sam, for unpacking all of that with us.
Always a pleasure to dive deep, Alex.